This White House isn't known for its policy specifics. There is a big speech tonight, though, that might change that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, the 28th and last day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin the program today with two pieces of tape, one reality check, and a whole bunch of context, all in the service of the president's speech to a joint session of Congress tonight. Piece of tape number one, which, yes, I realize, but I have to say this because people write in, isn't actually tape anymore, but a bunch of ones and zeros, is the president himself this morning on Fox News being asked about, kind of, and answering, kind of, how he is going to make the budget plan he is going to talk about tonight work.
Where's the money come from?
Well,
because it doesn't seem, if you cut all the money from EPA and all the money from SAFE, that's about $50 billion.
Well, I think the money's going to come from a revved up economy. I mean, you look at the kind of numbers we're doing. We were probably GDP of a little more than 1%. And if I can get that up to 3% or maybe more, we have a whole different ballgame.
Here's the reality check. GDP growth for the fourth quarter, which was confirmed this morning, is at 1.9% on an annualized basis. We have not been in this economy at 3% annual growth or more in literally 11 years. Which gets us to the budget speech tonight. The president has, during his campaign and in office so far, made running the government sound basically easy. Budgeting in particular. Cut here, add there, boom, you got a budget. Oh, that it were so simple. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams thus has context story number one, the realities of budget making in this political Washington.
President Trump would like to run the government like a business, but especially when it comes to the budget, there are some key differences. For one, members of Congress who have to pass the budget are not Trump's employees. Joe White of Case Western Reserve University has been studying the budget process for decades.
In a business, he can say, "You're fired," to people who don't cooperate, whereas he can't fire Paul Ryan and he can't fire, you know, any senators.
Another difference, cutting spending from one area doesn't necessarily free up money for something else, because politics. Lindsay Koshgarian is research director at the Nonpartisan National Priorities Project. She points out budget caps previously passed by Congress enforce the idea of parity, which
basically means that any increase in military spending would be matched by a corresponding increase in domestic spending. And of course, Trump's proposal throws all of that away.
Trump wants a $54 billion increase in defense spending, partly paid for by cutting non-defense spending. But he can't do that without Congress. Bill Hoagland is senior vice president at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He says there's a reason Trump is targeting this discretionary spending.
This is in some ways an easy area to address because we're leaving off the table the fastest growing components of spending.
Those are entitlements like Social Security and Medicare, which make up about two-thirds of the federal budget.
Unless, of course, you're talking about increasing taxes to pay for the increased spending.
And it's unlikely Trump would want to suggest that in his primetime speech. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Okay, here's piece of tape number two. Let's play it, and then I'll talk about it a little bit.
If you don't fund the State Department fully, then I need to buy more ammunition, ultimately. So I think it's a cost-benefit ratio. The more that we put into the State Department's diplomacy, hopefully the less we have to put into a military budget as we deal with the outcome of an apparent American withdrawal from the international scene.
That was then Marine Corps General James Mattis, at the time in charge of Central Command. Now, of course, he's the Secretary of Defense, talking about the choices that get made in federal budgeting. The choice President Trump has made, based on the proposal the White House released yesterday, and as Kimberly said, is an extra $54 billion for the Pentagon, a 10% increase in its annual budget, paid for in part by an as much as 30% cut to the Department of State. It's a classic hard power, soft power budgeting balancing act. And the subject of context story number two from Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
Ask a veteran diplomat what soft power is, and here's what you get.
The ability to influence situations and people in a manner that doesn't employ the barrel of a gun.
That's Vernon Penner, a former U.S. ambassador now at Bridgewater State University. He says soft power can be used to end wars. It can also pave the way for U.S. exports by, say, establishing protections for U.S. trademarks or contracts, says Heather Conley, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary at the State Department, now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Still, Conley says you could make some cuts that wouldn't diminish our soft powers.
The State Department structures in Washington could use for some trimming. The bureaucracy has become a bit bloated.
But Conley stresses she's talking about streamlining, not deconstructing the State Department. Jeremy Shapiro is a former State Department advisor, now at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He says don't slash embassy budgets or foreign disaster aid. We need that in our soft power arsenal. But Shapiro thinks President Trump could cut some recurring aid programs that other countries take for granted.
Generally, when you spend money, they just sort of want more and then get mad at you if you withdraw it.
And speaking of spending money, the battles in Congress over all federal agency budgets are just beginning. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Smart Money says it's not going to be all budget tonight in the speech. There are reports that immigration is going to make an appearance, national security as well, probably also jobs. The president has talked a lot about how he's going to bring jobs back to this economy, coal jobs in particular. In China, though, a great coal turnabout seems to be underway. Beijing announced today that coal use there has fallen for the third year in a row, and a lot of analysts are suggesting it ain't coming back. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
Chinese data can be sketchy, but with coal, a lot of arrows are pointing the same direction. Coal use, down. Carbon emissions, down. Coal-fired power plant builds, halted. Energy-thirsty factories, running less. Jane Nakano is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Consumption seems to have peaked. The Chinese have been expanding the use of non-coal resources, but not just non-coal, but like non-fossil fuel resources.
Oil use is slowing too, just as competing energies are exploding in China. Nuclear, hydropower, wind, solar. Tim Donaghy is a Greenpeace researcher.
In 2015, they set a record for the total number of solar panels installed, and they actually doubled that number in 2016. It's basically the equivalent of 3 football fields of solar panels being installed every hour for an entire year.
It's not so much a Chinese love affair with the planet. Beijing wants to produce world-beating renewables companies. And it wants world recognition on climate change, even as the new U.S. president doubles down on fossil energy. Judith Shapiro at American University is the author of China's Environmental Challenges.
Whether the Chinese are going to be as active as the world needs is another question, but certainly I give them a great deal of credit for not saying, oh, well, now the U.S. isn't doing it, so we aren't doing it either.
Not long ago, she says, China was a laggard on climate issues. Now, she adds, that label falls on a different country. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, no lucky 13. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The day before Inauguration Day, we did the show from Erie, Pennsylvania, a first pass at our year-long reporting project there that we're calling The Big Promise. What a county that went Obama, Obama, Trump the last three election cycles is expecting out of the new administration. One of the people we had on was Scott Slauson. He is the president of Local 506 of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. Scott, it is good to talk to you again.
It's good to talk to you.
Last time we talked to you, Scott, I asked you what you were looking for out of the Trump administration, what you wanted out of him based on the promises that he had made. It's a little bit of a long piece of tape. We're going to play it for you, and then I want to talk about it. Here you go.
Sure.
Honestly, nothing. I'm not looking for anything. No, we are marketing. We're doing it ourselves, and we were doing it before he came along, and we'll be doing it after he's gone. I mean, that's the way it is.
So this idea of trade protection and tariffs and
yeah, all you know, of that. you can dismantle free trade acts and you can do all this, but you can't do it overnight. It's not unrealistic to believe that other countries aren't going to retaliate. and get us into a trade war. We don't make a lot of products in this country anymore. So when you look at just dismantling free trade acts, remember, we don't make toothpaste here. We don't make televisions here. A tube of toothpaste goes from $3 to $20 overnight. These are things we need to think about realistically.
You still feel that way, that you're not looking for this president to help you out much?
I think I was pretty firm then, and again, I think my stance is still the same. I mean, I think that this president has the ability to start moving this country in the right direction, but you're not going to undo 30, 40 years of this type of behavior in 2 or 3 years, and it's dangerous to think that we can.
What's the hope? What's the positive part of this?
Well, I think the hope is, or the positive part is that we do start moving this country economically in the right direction. I mean, for the last 15 or so years, I mean, we have seen billionaires take over this country and control government. We've seen, CEOs' wages rise at alarming rates while the average working American, their wages have stagnated. That doesn't do the economy any good. So the hope is that we start to see at a gradual pace, good quality American jobs coming back so that our children have a future.
It's worth a note here that we now have a billionaire in the White House, and yet many, many people voted for him based on the promises that you talked about right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's two sides of that logic, right? A billionaire, a lot of people have the belief that, politicians have stopped listening to what the average working people are saying, and it's time to put a businessman in charge of a country because they know how to run business, and our country should be treated like a business. Then there's the other side of that that says, no, that's far from the truth. Do you put a billionaire in office to fix problems that were created by billionaires?
I know you said you're not looking for much out of the White House in terms of, their ability to directly impact you and your members and that slice of Pennsylvania. But if we call you, we're going to call you sooner than that, but if we called you cold in a year and said, listen, how's it been for you? What do you guess your answer would be?
Hopefully it's a positive story. I mean, the problem we face here in Erie is we've had a lot of manufacturing walk out of this area. We used to have 50,000 manufacturing employees. We're down to about 20,000. Our population is dropping. And these are all things that we have been working on as a team. People that don't normally sit in the same room together. Normally they sit at opposite ends of the table. We've been sitting down ourselves collectively saying, how do we market this area? How do we market this workforce? And how do we bring manufacturing back to this area on our own?
So you're hopeful then?
Very hopeful.
Scott Slauson is the president of Local 506 of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers Union of America. We got him in Erie, Pennsylvania. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We're going to take a minute now, a minute and 54 seconds, actually, for an installment of our series, My Economy, how people are getting by out there in the day-to-day. We go to the San Francisco Bay Area now to hear from a 25-year-old who went where the jobs are.
My name is John Williams. To me, the economy seems sluggish but decent. I think, personally, we have an economy that basically burdens young people with debt to supplement larger businesses. Basically, banks. My older brother has a bachelor's degree in European history. He is teaching English in a foreign country because he can't find a job in America. My sister has a bachelor's degree in economics. She works in marketing at a bank. So everyone I know who got a degree basically did the same thing. They went into a lot of debt. They started the jobs, and everyone wanted 10 years experience, but they wanted to pay entry-level wage. I kept trying to think of jobs that are necessary that don't need degrees. I've noticed that the world is changing quite rapidly. And so I thought of a job that nobody really wants to do. I noticed somebody was broken down the side of the road, and I thought, maybe I could be a mechanic. So I went into work on buses in this small town outside of San Luis Obispo. I moved somewhere no one wanted to live, and I did a job no one wanted to do. From there, I used my skill sets, and I kept moving on, and I moved back to the Bay Area.
Basically, tech companies got so frustrated with the public transit because their employees kept being late that they actually have their own bus systems. And so because of that, I kind of jumped on that ride. And because the tech workers make so much money and the tech companies make so much money, they pay so much money for the bus systems.
I would personally love to go to school. One of the things I've really been interested in is robotics. I do believe that my industry will eventually go away
because I do see a future where there aren't as many large diesel vehicles on the road, or they're going to be either self-driving or self-maintaining. I would like to get a bachelor's eventually in engineering. It's what I really wanted to do, but I didn't want to go into debt.
John Williams, he's 25 years old. We got him in Santa Rosa, California. We would love it if you would share your story with us. There is a place you can do that, marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up,
we have this population that we recruited, but we never developed.
The labor force of the future straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials broke its 12-day winning streak, dipped 25 points, did the blue chips a 10th percent, 20,812. The NASDAQ gave back 36 points, about 6-tenths percent, 5825. The S&P 500 released 6 points, about a quarter percent, ended the session at 2363 for the month. And don't be surprised if you hear these numbers tonight during the speech. The Dow up 4.8%, the NASDAQ and the S&P each added 3.7%. Target started today's trouble with a terrible, terrible, terrible earnings report. Forecast was lousy, too. The discount retailer thus plunged more than 12%, and that put a bullseye on other retailers' backs. Kohl's unloaded more than 2%, Nordstrom down 2%, Macy's down about 1%. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on this program every day,
technology, the economy, pop culture,
check out our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, me and Molly Wood.
We've got new episodes every week. Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts.
Follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm at Molly Wood.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Go ahead and add another player to the ever-contentious battle for your eyeballs. YouTube announced a live streaming service this afternoon. Access to the four big broadcast networks, a host of cable channels as well. Marketplace's Adrian Hill covers entertainment for us. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
All right, this is a big deal, actually. Walk me through it. What's so special?
So YouTube is basically launching a service that's going to combine the YouTube content we know and love with live national and local television. It's got the big networks signed on. A bunch of the cable networks are here, and they're looking for that sort of magic combination that's going to get more people cutting the cord.
And that is, we should say here, a space that is getting crowded very quickly, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of services out there trying to figure this out. Dish has Sling TV. Sony has PlayStation View. Hulu is reportedly working on a live TV service. And Apple, Kai, Apple TV, your guess is as good as mine right now. But, you know, Tim Cook in a recent earnings call basically predicted the demise of the traditional cable bundle.
Yeah, and we're still waiting for Apple TV, obviously. What is YouTube's special sauce here then?
Well, so there's a couple things it's offering. One is the integration of YouTube content with more traditional TV. And this makes some sense if you think about it. YouTube says around the world, people watch 1 billion hours of YouTube content a day.
No!
A day.
Oh, my God.
Like, I double-checked this because I was like, there's no way that can be true. Yeah. But so they're going to offer – so that content will be there right along with television and – and the original content that YouTube has been producing for YouTube Red. They're also promising to use everything they know about search to help make the process of finding the next show or the next thing or the next video I want to watch better. And the biggie here, Kai, is for folks who record television, they're offering a cloud with no DVR limit. So you record away.
Which for those of us who wind up going through and deleting all your kids' programs, is kind of a big deal. We should say here that YouTube is owned by Google, right? So that's how they know the search thing. How much is this going to cost me, and can I get it, like, today when I go home?
You cannot get it today when you go home. They're working on it right now. They're promising to charge $35, which puts it in line with some of the other services out there. But that's for 6 accounts, Kai. So you and your kids can all have different personalized recommendations and your different DVR clouds.
Which settles the whole who's this for thing, right? Because it's for me and my kids as well, right?
So if they're super into magic videos, those aren't going to pop up in your queue.
Yeah, no. Marketplace's Adrian Hill out at the YouTube space on the other side of LA. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks, Guy.
More than half of the jobs in this economy are what are called middle-skill jobs, work that requires more than a high school diploma but not quite a 4-year college degree. A lot of those jobs are in manufacturing, where you need technical skills to operate the machines and the robots that are doing more and more of the actual labor. Our education correspondent Amy Scott has been reporting on how employers are working with high schools and community colleges to train the next generation of young workers, but companies are turning to their existing workers as well. Today, Amy picks up the story in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Inside a cavernous building, solid bars of copper are heated and stretched into miles and miles of shiny tubing. This is Cambridge Lee Industries. For 75 years, this plant on the Schuylkill River has produced copper tubing mostly for plumbing, heating, and refrigeration.
Across the United States, Cambridge Lee copper tubing's in just about one of every 4 homes.
Mike Fischetti is the company's new vice president of human resources, and he's facing a challenge a lot of manufacturers in the area have, an aging workforce. During the long manufacturing downturn in the 1990s and 2000s, the factories that survived had no trouble finding skilled workers, and many didn't invest in training younger ones.
Over time, that has now hurt our organization, where we have a population that are very far along in their career that are really good, but we have this population that we recruited but we never developed.
Now the economy is growing, and about a quarter of the area's manufacturing workforce is set to retire in the next 10 years. So employers like Cambridge Lee are scrambling for skilled workers. Fischetti says the company did offer help with training if employees wanted to do it on their own.
We said, if you want to increase your skill set, pick a class, pay for it, go to it. If you pass, we'll reimburse you. And so I asked, well, how effective was that? How many people did that? And the answer was none.
Why would they go to class in their spare time, he says, when they were working 60 or 70 hours a week? So Fischetti started a new program to pay workers to go to Reading Area Community College. One day a week, they work a half shift and then spend the rest of the day in class learning how to troubleshoot and repair mechanical breakdowns. In one of the plant's newer buildings, workers unspool shiny copper tubing from giant coils and cut it into 60-foot sections. One of the trainees, 23-year-old Alexander Jones, is in charge of making sure the machines keep running properly and repairing them when they don't.
Today, I've actually been called over here twice already for just little stuff. I mean, most of the conveyors here and everything, it's not very complex. It's pretty simple. But with the add-on of this machine, it's going to be a little different.
The new machine he's talking about will automatically cut sections of tubing to precise lengths, and that takes more sophisticated skills to maintain. In class, Jones is learning how mechanical and hydraulic systems work.
Now I'm able to understand it a lot quicker and diagnose the issues a lot quicker, which, you know,
relates to less downtime for machines.
Those skills could also lead to a few dollars an hour more in pay. The training isn't cheap. It'll cost about $62,000 for the first crop of 16 workers. But Cambridge Lee will be reimbursed more than half of that with state and federal funds. Fred Diedrich is CEO of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions, which promotes partnerships between industry and educators. He says for most companies, the skills of their workers are their most important asset.
Without them being highly skilled, they will go out of business. That's what's different about advanced manufacturing. You cannot be successful unless you have highly skilled employees.
There's always a risk those skills will walk out the door. But Cambridge Lee's Mike Fischetti believes investing in workers will make them want to stay. And just in case, he has an insurance policy. If workers pass the training and leave within 2 years, they're on the hook for some of the cost. In Reading, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, in which I remark, and not for the first time either, that I really need to write a book. Of course, I need to get elected president first, I guess. The Financial Times reports today that the bidding for the rights to memoirs by Barack and Michelle Obama has topped $60 million. That's 60 million. It's a package deal, apparently. Two books, one really high price. My goodness, look at the time we got to go. The Dow off 25 points today, about a 10%, broke that 12-day winning streak. The NASDAQ gave back 36 points, about 0.6%. S&P 500 lost 6 points, a 0.25% there. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rosdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.